John. Big John.
Every morning at the mine you could see him arrive. He stood 6'6" and weighed 245, kind of broad at the shoulder and narrow at the hip. And everybody knew you didn't give no lip to Big John.
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
Nobody seemed to know where John called home. He just drifted into town and stayed all alone. He didn't say much, he kind of quiet and shy. And if you spoke at all, you just said hi to Big John. Somebody said he came from New Orleans, where he got in a fight over a Cajun queen, and a crashing blow from a huge right hand sent a Louisiana fella to the promised land. Big John.
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
Then came the day at the bottom of the mine when a timber cracked and men started crying. Miners were praying and hearts beat fast, and everybody thought that they'd breathed their last, except John. Through the dust and the smoke of this man-made hell walked a giant of a man that the miners knew well. Grabbed a sagging timber and gave out with a groan, and like a giant oak tree just stood there alone, Big John.
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
And with all of his strength he gave a mighty shove. Then a miner yelled out, "There's a light up above." And 20 men scrambled from a would-be grave. Now there's only one left down there to save Big John. With jacks and timbers they started back down. Then came that rumble way down in the ground, and as smoke and gas belched out of that mine, everybody knew it was the end of the line for Big John.
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
Now they never reopened that worthless pit. They just placed a marble stand in front of it. These few words are written on that stand: "At the bottom of this mine lies one hell of a man, Big John."
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
Stumble from my good warm bed Monday morning, oh my head. Gotta go and do it all again. Wake up, baby, rise and shine. It's coffee, eggs, and bacon time. Walk your working man out to the car. Boss is in his usual mood. Not one thing does he approve. Sometimes you can't keep him satisfied. Up and down the assembly line, worried faces much like mine, showing the wear and tear in their eyes. Policeman in his prime sits behind his billboard sign, aims his radar gun right straight at me. A letter from the IRS said, "Boy, your taxes are a mess." His Is this the way the good life's supposed to be? They're making it hard on the working man, trying to make a living any way he can. Making ends meet on the installment plan, his money goes right through his hand. Heaven help him if you think you can. They're making it hard on the working man. Stumble from my good warm bed Monday morning, oh my head. Gotta go and do it all again. Too much room in the Frigidaire. The kids all need new shoes to wear. Payments late on my old truck again. They're making it hard on the working man, trying to make a living any way he can. Making ends meet on the installment plan, his money goes right through his hand. Heaven help him if you think you can. They're making it hard on the working man. They're making it hard on the working man, trying to make a living any way he can. Making ends meet on the installment plan, his money goes right through his hand.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. It's Terrible Tommy in the bunker, and it's, what is it? Labor Day. White Labor Day. That's what we call it. That's what my big sign says out on the road outside my house, and I get a lot of people honking. They like that. Support white labor. Yeah, and it is, what is it, the 5th of September 2016, and we're going to do a little show for you, and I think I'm going to put on my old buddy John Jewell, who did better at talking for white labor than even I do, and that's amazing. Don't know whatever happened to John Jewell. He just sort of faded out. I do know that he had an alcohol problem at one time, and I've had two or three people who were really good supporters and contributed a lot to this movement that just couldn't beat the alcohol, and it's a shame. Let's see what John's got to say. This was back in the 80s that we recorded this.
Out there, I was living on a paratrooper base. It was blacks, Puerto Ricans, and poor whites. Some of the worst trash that I've ever seen. I lived in a home where we got the phone calls every night of German women, German children, little German girls, five-year-old girls, raped, murdered by American troops over there. At 14 years of age, I started speaking out on military bases and in military schools against the U.S. Army being in Europe, against NATO, against the capitalist exploitation of the world. And, of course, I got it down on me.
How long were you over there in Germany?
About 4 years. And during this period, I started reading about the true history of America, the labor struggle, all the rebellions of farmers and working people in America.
Are you trying to say that we're not getting history, the real history of the United States?
We're getting nothing but lies, nothing but lies. When you finally understand how this nation was formed and who fought for this nation, the farmers and the workers, and they've been nothing has ever gone for them except exploitation.
Now, how can that happen? Now, that information must be around. I know you write about it extensively because
you got to dig deep for it.
Well, you're a revisionist.
But I was very fortunate because there was a family tradition. My great-great-grandfather that came out to California in 1889, he was a Granger farmer. He was a populist. He was busted out of his farm, and he went with Debs into the Socialist Party, and he went into the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, a wobbly like I became. And I'm not ashamed of that, and you can call me what you want, a red or whatever. I'm a white working man, and I know what I stand for.
But you're a revisionist, but a working man's revisionist. You know, there's a lot of revisionism going on.
They're reactionary revisionists. I'm a revolutionary revisionist. I'm showing the true revolutionary history of the white working people.
Now, I know I see that in your articles, that things that I've never seen, because normal revisionism that I've seen lately just talks about some things.
No, they want to talk about the Holocaust until you can't even listen to it anymore. That's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about our people, the white working people, farmers and workers, and what was done to us, and because it shows us what we have to do now.
So it was you're more interested in the Holocaust against white workers in this
against
country.
The white workers in this country, which is my people and the experience that I've gone through.
Okay, so you come back from Germany. What's your next step?
Well, the area that I came from, the draft was 100% for Vietnam. That's because our draft board wasn't in our area. I lived in an okey-arky white trash area. The draft board was across the river in a nice rich area, and the women on the draft board were putting through bogus draft deferrals for all the rich boys in their neighborhood and hit every one of us in the working class districts. Those women, by the way, were finally charged during the Watergate period and prosecuted for the fraud that they committed. So I joined the Air Force. I went in thinking that I was going to go over and fight the Red Chinese against my race enemy. I got onto that Air Force base after I went through my basic training. I got into air police training. I was a few weeks away from Vietnam. I had two very interesting experiences. Number one, hundreds and hundreds of South Vietnamese air pilot trainees, these small, skinny little South Vietnamese wandering around the base. And I thought, these are my allies. These are the people that I'm going to go fight for. And I said, no. The other thing is I went down to San Antonio to see the Alamo, the great symbol of the white race, where white men stood and died for their people, for their white race. It was in the worst, filthiest Mexican storm.
Oh, that's a mess down there. I remember one time I was written by a conservative in Texas, and they were trying to pump up the conservative right-wing thing in Texas, and I said, until you go down and clean out that Alamo and make it a holy shrine
for the white race,
for the white race, and clear all that crap and the greasers out from a half mile or a mile around, don't talk to me.
Yeah, Mexican whores, Mexican pimps, Mexican cutthroats, they had to warn soldiers going down there not to wander more than a half a block from the spotlights in the Alamo or you get your throat cut.
Well, now even the greaseballs are climbing up to the top of the Alamo planting foreign flags.
And smashing down the walls. That's what's happened to this country.
Well,
so I said, I am not going. And I didn't go. And I got out with an honorable discharge. Not a dishonorable bad conduct. Not general discharge, an honorable discharge, because I stood my ground and said, I will not go to fight that war for those yellow people in South Vietnam.
And it's turned out that it was just another one of those phony wars.
Another phony war that got more of our boys killed, like all those wars before that the rich man started.
Well, just like the general used to say, war is a racket, right?
It's a racket to make money for the rich.
And I went halfway through the war supporting it, saying, hey, we're going to fight these Chinese and these Asians, and then decided, look, they're just killing people for nothing. Our people are getting destroyed over the best of the white race, dying for nothing. Our war is here, isn't it, John?
Our war is right here, and that's where I fought it. Bring the war home in the streets. I wasn't a pacifist. I wasn't a peacenik. I fought the cops in the streets. They charged us with batons. They charged us mass motorcycle charges. Blood in the streets, bodies in the streets. I was a fighting man in the streets. I fought the Vietnam War here where it really counted.
And that was like in L.A. and
L.A. throughout Southern California. And if you don't think that we shed some blood out there, too.
And that was a time when you and I, in a lot of ways, were on opposite sides because we were deluded. We were saying, gee, we got to be for the United States and we got to be for the war and like that. But yet, really, we all should have been out in the streets on that.
We all should have been out in the streets, and I shouldn't have been in with the group I was in, with a bunch of Jewish Marxists, then sold out along the way and became a bunch of yuppies and Zionists.
Yeah, where did they all go to?
Yeah, all these great Jewish revolutionaries that were playing Ho Chi Minh and Mao Zedong, Che Guevara types, they all scrammed as soon as the war was over, became yuppie capitalists, Zionists, right-wingers.
Stockbrokers and everything.
Stockbrokers and the like. I saw them all scrammed like a bunch of rats deserting a sinking ship.
So you fought for a long period like that in the streets.
And not just in America. I was in Paris during the 68 revolt. and I made it through Europe all the way into Asia. I didn't go to Asia as a soldier. I went to Asia on my own. What? And I saw what the squalid mess of those non-whites are in those countries. I went down through Turkey, Iran. I saw the Shah's Iran. I saw why the Shah was overthrown. I went to Afghanistan right before the king was overthrown, up through the Khyber Pass, nearly got my throat
slit. Well, you hiked through there, didn't you?
I was on foot. Yeah, I was on foot, peasant buses, any way I could get along.
Not like the normal American
tourist.
No,
I didn't fly into Kathmandu with beads on like the Beatles. I was an adventurer on the road, and I saw what those people are living like. Pakistan, India, up into Nepal, up to Mount Everest. And I still had certain convictions, but I was starting to understand that the third world is just a squalid mess, and these people can't even organize themselves. I feel a certain pity for them. I support their national liberation struggles to get the fat cast off their neck. But if these non-whites cannot organize themselves, we can't feel any more pity for them, give them any more aid. We have our own battle to fight for the white race, the only people who can organize anything properly.
Because they're swarming over us like locusts, and the fat cats love it. This feudal, corporate feudalism.
Corporate feudalism.
Isn't that what we're fighting now?
That's exactly what we're fighting now. We're going back to like the Middle Ages when you had a bunch of serfs down in the fields.
There is no U.S. government anymore. That's just a front office, isn't it?
It's the front office for Wall Street and the banks. The people that have no feeling or patriotism for the white race that they came from, the white race that built this country.
And
it's
so,
the white working man that's down in the gutter now. They're elevating all these third world types in this country and shoving us, the white workers and farmers, down in the gutter.
Well, I notice every government building you go in now is almost all non-whites in the offices.
Yeah, and where are the white guys? They're out on the street with no jobs. They're taking the lowest paid things.
And the white people are aborting their children, killing their own kind.
While all government grants go out to third world types to have even more and more children.
Now, you went through this and really went around the world, saw it the way it was, and you came back.
And I came back, and I continued fighting. And I saw that I couldn't work with these communist Jewish groups. And I got into the only white group that I could find, and that was the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, almost totally Anglo-white. No blacks, a few scattering Mexicans, a few small clique of Jews, all the ones that later sold out and deserted ship. We fought the labor struggle. All through the 70s, we were organizing unions, going down into places that none of the other fat cat labor unions would touch. We'd organize any worker. We fought on the strike line, on the picket line, against the police. That's what I did for 10 years.
Now, the IWW, for a lot of young people, they're not that familiar with it. I mean, the IWW goes back a long way.
All the way back to 1905, Revolutionary Labor Union, an independent labor union, non-communist. Was never in with the communists. They fought a freedom fight for the workers of this country, and they were smashed by the government for some of the worst repression under sedition laws, under criminal syndicalism laws, men put into prison for life or murdered in prison. And now what do we see again? We see white working class kids on the street being charged with sedition, criminal syndicalism. A skinhead right here in Southern California charged with criminal syndicalism for a minor offense.
And that's
they're drudging up all these old laws they used to smash the white workers movement. Again, now to smash even skinheads.
And the skinhead was interviewed. He didn't even know what
criminal syndicalism
he didn't even
is.
Know what the IWW was. And he's being charged
well,
with
well, that's why these kids have got to start learning a little bit about history, what went on in this country, to understand what they're doing us again. This is not any new. This is the old bag of tricks they used before to smash the white working class.
So you're down on the street organizing for the IWW, and you're writing.
Right.
And you're producing pamphlets. And
so what happened? Well, first of all, the whole left fell to pieces, and all the rats deserted the ship. They started getting into the gay movement, lesbianism, all the faggots. They started getting into black liberation, but guilt trip for white workers, which I wouldn't stand for. So what happened? They brought me up on white racism charges. I was going to be hauled 3,000 miles across this continent to be put on a kangaroo trial
for
being a white racist.
The leaders of your own union.
I was one of the leaders. I was an executive board member, and I was the head of the General Defense Committee. And they were going to haul me for a kangaroo trial, charging that I was a white racist.
This reminds me of a recent incident, a white racialist back in Oklahoma. He's working for one of the big airplane factories. He had a symbol on, you know, I'm white and proud. Fired him. Lost his job. Now he's lost his house because the blacks complained. The union wouldn't support him. Everybody's getting a break but Whitey.
Oh, the AFL-CIO has always been a sellout. They've always been trying to destroy the white working class. you can't expect anything from them.
Now,
if we're going to have any kind of labor union, it's got to be a white workers' union, the way it used to be in the old days when the white working man fought. White working men have got to get together and start fighting these fat cats.
Now, your articles are really hard-hitting.
I talk about war. I talk about rebellion in the streets. I talk about the bloodshed in this country, what made this country.
You talk about the green corn rebellion in Oklahoma. You've talked about the railroad wars where the farmers and the workers...
I talked about Rob the Bank, the story of Jesse James and the guerrilla struggle that went on for nearly 30 years in Missouri and the border area.
Now, this is information that I wasn't even aware of, and I thought I knew quite a bit about
it. I talked about the first revolution in America, not the American Revolution of 1776, as so many people talk about. 100 years before that, kill the governor, when the white farmers of Virginia rose up, overthrew the British government, and established a white republic.
And remember all those indentured servants and so forth, and everybody keeps talking about black slaves. We had thousands.
Where do you think we all come from? Most of us came over here as white slaves, white indentured servants, brought over here in chains in the holds of ships and used for 5 to 7 years as slaves in the fields.
And what about the wage slavery in the North? I mean, everybody talks about the black slavery, but look at how the way, and they talk about, oh, this country's for everybody and all that, which was the rich man's wage, is bringing more and more people in to pay him less and less money, right? And now they try to romanticize it.
Of course.
Like they planned it, like humanitarians.
That's why they killed Abraham Lincoln. The rich men killed Abraham Lincoln because he said right before his death that his plan was to deport the blacks to Central America and back to Africa to give jobs to white men. The more blacks that were sent off to another country to settle would be more jobs for white men, and he was shot then.
And Andrew Johnson, the man that succeeded him, was even more that way as far as I can see.
He tried his best because he was a white working man himself from the backwoods of Tennessee. He fought for the white working people. And that's why they tried to impeach him, to shove him out of the presidency.
Yeah, they crucified him. And as they try to crucify anybody who comes out for basic working people in this country, whites better get their act together, don't you think?
We're on our last leg now. If white working men don't start standing up now, they might as well slit their throats. Go marry some non-white woman and have half-breed kids, because that's what it's come down to.
So they drug you back before this committee and raked you over the coals?
No. They left me. I never quit. They went their way. I went my way. Now, when I went my way independently, I went through some pretty dark years looking around for somebody I could work with. And what did I find? I found Hollywood Nazis. I found fake so-called Ku Klux Klansmen. And they threatened me. They attacked my home. They threatened my life. But I didn't keep my mouth shut. I spoke out for what I believe in. And finally, after all these years, I have found the organization, the only organization in this entire country that's fighting for white working people, and that's WAR. WAR, White Aryan Resistance.
That must have been tough, because we know that a lot of this conservative movement is a sham. Most of it is a sham. There's some innocent people in there that would need the right information, and I think they'll do right. But
they also need a little guts, a little spirit. They've got to understand that they've got to fight. There's no way that paper petitions and voting are going to do anything.
Yeah, but look at how... Remember World War II, and I remember the Klan. They were all thrilled about, oh, we're real pro-American. We're going to go and bomb the hell out of white Germans.
Well, they started out saying, we're going to go kill the Japanese, which was great because they're non-whites. Then they turn around and start killing German children. That's how they ended up. All these great white patriots ended up in Germany butchering those people.
Why did a lot of working people end up in this conservative camp? It don't make sense. I know that the non-conservative camp started catering to blacks and Jews and everyone else. But still, why did the racial movement in this country, why was it sold out to the conservative movement? Because the conservative movement is a total sham.
A total sham.
The President Reagan, well, the Great White Hope,
right.
He's a perfect example of conservatism running score. Isn't conservatism really dead in this country?
Conservatism is dead. Those people are liberals. The President is a liberal. He's pushing the same old liberal line.
Well, what about Central America? I mean, they're wanting to send us down there, sending thousands of whites down there again to fight in that war down there that they're getting ready to have.
Because they want to grab that area back is all they want to do for their money-making ventures.
Well, again, our war is here, John, don't you believe?
Certainly not in Nicaragua. If those people down there have the guts to stand up and seize their own country back, I say all power to them. I may not agree with their communism. I may not agree with their Marxism. But I certainly agree with their spirit and their guts that they're willing to fight. If more people would fight in this country the way they fought in Nicaragua, we'd be a heck of a lot better.
Well, look what the government's doing today. They shot down and murdered, burnt to death Gordon Call, tax protester. Hardly anybody even talks about it. Then there was Arthur Kirk. They shot him down, a farmer trying to save his farm. Then you had Sanger up in Utah. His only crime was wanting to educate his own children at home. He was murdered, and it goes on and on. So who is our enemy? Who really is our enemy? I don't think my enemies are way off someplace. I think my enemies are very close at hand.
They're just down the street. They're just outside the door. We have to understand we're in a white civil war. Our primary battle is not against non-whites. Our primary battle is not against the Jews. It's against our own people, the sellouts within our own race that only care about money, don't give a damn about white working people. Those are the enemy.
Because the real leadership in the country, the race traders, are still white.
Of course they're
most
white.
Of the governors are white. Most of the Congress and Senate are white. But they, what do? They passed another civil rights law the other day, strengthening the civil rights laws to give more to the minorities and rob
the
white whites,
working people.
The whites. What's it going to take, John? What's it going to take before this pot boils over?
Well, I think there's going to have to be a heck of a lot more repression to wake some of these people up. This country has become fat, flabby, cowardly. But we're starting to see now in the streets that there are some white people waking
and
up.
And among the young.
Among the young. And I'm talking about young workers. I'm talking about young white skinheads, both skinhead men and skinhead women. The ones that are willing to fight in the streets for their race.
You go down into these fat cat neighborhoods and along the coast of California and other places where all these rich people live, and those kids gather at night, they're driving Mercedes-Benz, Porsches and everything. Everything's a lark to them. It's handed to them on a silver platter. They could give a damn less about their race.
Yeah, and their parents don't give a damn either. They may vote conservative and wave the American flag, but it means nothing to them. What does the American flag mean anymore? The American flag at one time meant the white race that made this nation.
There's a few flags around the country that mean something. That Confederate flag means a lot to a lot of people. We've got a California flag that's a rebel flag, too.
Yeah, that's what I like about the California flag, especially the other day when we were in court looking up at that judge sneering down at us with the California bear flag. Nice red star, big bear, nice red star stripe across the bottom, the California Republic. The California Republic was the white men of California who rose up in rebellion against the Mexican dictatorship, defeated the Mexicans, established a white man's commonwealth.
So we've got to get that history out to the people. You've been doing a tremendous job with your research, the best that I have ever seen. And I'm telling you that your writings are becoming more popular. We're educating more people around the country.
I just don't want to educate them. I want to stir them up. I want to get them back to their roots, to what white men were once in this country. Fighters, warriors, get out there and fight for your people.
You mean politics of the deed, John?
Politics of the deed.
We need more politics of the deed.
Propaganda of the deed.
Lots of people writing, but not too many people fighting. A lot of intellectual stuff floating around, but not too many combination people like you, a writer and a fighter. John, it's been great to have you with us today.
Thank you, sir.
Hope you come back again. We'll do another segment. And thank you out there. And remember, free speech, Whitey.
John Jewell was one of the best writers, revolutionary writers I ever put on the show. And his material we have on a website. And it needs to get out more and more to white working people because they're not thinking about their own self-interest. I think I'm going to run on this Labor Day. I'm going to run this speech by Ben Klassen, Survival of the White Race. This was a lecture from 1975. I knew Ben quite well from the very beginning. We had our good times and we had our bad times. We had our disagreements, we had our squabbles, but we ended up still friends. That's the way politics are. Some things you agree with, some things you don't. But I'm going to play this without making any comments during the talk. Okay. One thing before we do that, Ben is the most unrecognized racial leader that's come on the scene. And the right wing and the conservatives hated his guts. They smeared him, they accused him of all kinds of ridiculous crimes and so forth and everything, which were all total falsehoods put out by the right-wing conservatives in this country. If everybody that got behind him, he'd have had something really going, but he spent his fortune on creativity and the Church of the Creator. So here we go.
What I have to say in the next 40 minutes is probably going to
It might even profoundly shake up some of your most cherished superstitions and pet presumptions that you may have nurtured all your life, without perhaps ever bothering to examine the validity or worthiness of those presumptions. This discussion is going to delve seriously into race and religion, two subjects which our power establishment tells us we must never discuss, unless, of course, you are a Jew or a black or some other so-called minority. Today we are going to defy the Jew-controlled power structure and discuss race and religion from the white man's point of view. In particular, we are interested in examining whether we, the white race, are going to survive or whether we are going to be mongrelized and destroyed in a flood tide of parasitical colored races. Therefore, I want you to decide early in this presentation whether you are interested in the survival of your own kind, or whether you prefer to be a traitor to the white race and would just as soon see it wiped from the face of the earth and supplanted by niggers, blacks, yellows, Semites, and other mud races. For make no mistake about it, the white race is a highly endangered species, a vanishing species, one that its enemies have decided must disappear from the face of the earth. If suicide of your own kind is what you wish to see, now is a good time to stop listening. If, on the other hand, you are loyal to your own kind and wish the white race to survive and prosper, then you undoubtedly are not only interested in hearing about the Church of the Creator, but also becoming a member of our religious movement. The creed and philosophy of our religion, called creativity, is set forth in our book, Nature's Eternal Religion. It is the white man's Bible, and its basic goal is not only the survival of the white race, but also its expansion and advancement. Since in this short dissertation, it is impossible to give the full basis of our religion, even in short summary, we must continually refer you back to our Bible, namely Nature's Eternal Religion, a book consisting of 508 pages and 49 chapters. Why are we so concerned about the survival of the white race? Basically, there are two overwhelming reasons. One, the white race is rapidly shrinking into extinction. And two, we are proud members of nature's most distinguished, intelligent, productive, and creative species. We are talking about our own survival, the survival of the white race. There are many other reasons we could cite, such as the preservation of civilization and everything else that is worthwhile in life. But all these other reasons become secondary. First and foremost, we of the Church of the Creator are concerned about the survival, expansion, and advancement of the white race for its own sake, period. The sum total of all our efforts and dedication revolve around that central issue. As soon as we begin to logically and calmly examine the impending destruction of the white race, our enemies immediately bristle and hurl at us all the time-worn cliches and invectives of racist, facet, Nazi, and a host of others. It seems that if the Jews are loyal to Israel and to their race, that is just wonderful. If the niggers organize for the sole interest of their race and shout, "Kill Whitey," that too is highly commendable. If the Indians organize and commit atrocities, that too is to be praised. For isn't the white man responsible for everybody else's shortcomings, stupidities, and their inabilities to cope? To which I say loudly and emphatically, no. We are not responsible for the shortcomings, defects, and stupidities of the niggers and their historical inability to create a civilization, nor to maintain it even when the white man has brought it to them. Nor are we responsible for the colored mud race's inability to cope with the problem of feeding themselves above a starvation level. In 6,000 years of recorded history, the blacks of Africa have never even so much as invented the wheel, a written alphabet, or much of anything else. No, we are not responsible for that. Nature made them dumb, shiftless, and lazy. You can take the nigger out of the jungle, but you cannot take the jungle out of the nigger. It is not our responsibility to compensate for their defects, nor is it our duty to incorporate them into our society or into our race and thereby poison our own racial bloodstream. On the contrary, the highest law of nature commands us to make every effort for our own race to survive, to expand, and advance the genetic quality of our future generations. There is a sinister race on the face of the earth that is working feverishly for the mongrelization and final liquidation of the white race. It is a tribe that is fanatically loyal to its own and fiercely hostile to all other races. That tribe is the tribe of Judah. The Jewish race has frantically been striving for the last several thousand years towards its ultimate goal, the genocide of the white race. As far back as 3,000 years ago, during the days of Solomon, the rough outlines of a Jewish conspiracy were hatched in which the final goal was the enslavement of all the other peoples of this planet and the possession of all the wealth, riches, and natural resources of the world. In the ensuing 3,000 years, the Jews have progressed steadily towards that goal and are now on the threshold of total success. For a more detailed history of the Jews and their conspiracy, read Chapter 6 of Nature's Eternal Religion, entitled Masters of Deceit, A Short History of the Jews. How, you might well ask, could the Jews possibly succeed in perpetrating such an outrage on the rest of the world? How, especially on the white race, which is highly intelligent, creative, and productive? Again, for the full story, we must refer you to Nature's Eternal Religion. But we can sketch a few of the significant factors in this limited discussion. For one thing, the Jews would never be able to get to first base if it weren't for certain serious idiosyncrasies in the white race itself. The Jews are extremely skillful mind manipulators. They are tremendously expertise at spreading lies and compounding confusion. They are the historical masters of deceit. In their conspiracy to confuse, deceive, and control the mind of the white man, they have had some incredible help from the white man himself. The best help the Jew has had are two suicidal weaknesses inherent in the white man's makeup, namely his gullibility and his susceptibility to superstition. It is one of the strange paradoxes of history that whereas the white man is the most intelligent, creative, and productive creature on the face of the earth, when it comes to being able to recognize his enemies and fight for his own survival, the white man is the most stupid creature on the face of the earth. And therein lies his Achilles' heel, which the Jews have exploited to the hilt. There are other weaknesses from which the white man suffers that have been of tremendous help in the Jewish program of enslavement. Some of these are the white man's naive sense of fair play, his sympathy for the underdog, his extraordinary and exaggerated sense of compassion, his inability to realize his own outstanding worth. But far more devastating has been the white man's fatal susceptibility towards superstition, gullibility, and his strange inability to recognize his mortal enemies. Let us remember these two words, superstition and gullibility. They go together. Superstition deals with believing in the supernatural. Spooks, spirits, gods, devils, angels, witches, fairies, gremlins, ghosts, etc. Gullibility refers to foolishly believing in things that aren't so, without bothering to check for evidence. These two debilities of the mind, gullibility and superstition, are the basis of almost all religious faiths that have ever been invented and perpetrated on a long-suffering humanity. If you can get people to believe in spooks in the sky, then they are often more real to the believers than the real world. Furthermore, in their fantasy, the spooks often become more important to people than the real world. They also become an extremely powerful weapon in the hands of con artists in controlling the masses of their gullible believers. It is very similar to scaring little children with a boogeyman. If they believe, then they are as afraid of an imaginary boogeyman as if he were real. Believing in a fantasy makes the fantasy as real to the believer as reality itself, and often even more so. The point is that the imposter, who claims to be in with and have influence with the spooks in the sky, has a powerful weapon in his hands with which to frighten and manipulate the minds of his gullible victims. And so it has been throughout the history of mankind. A book I have read shows that people have invented more than 30,000 gods and goddesses that gullible and superstitious fools believed in even before the Jews invented their particular versions of Jehovah, Jabba, Jesus Christ, the Holy Ghost, Satan, and a host of other imaginary spooks. The Jews, in their search of how to control and manipulate people's minds, discovered early in their history what a powerful weapon spookcraft or religion was. They utilized this discovery to its fullest in two directly opposite ways. They invented Jehovah as their own private god to bind their own people together into a fanatic racial loyalty such as the world had never seen before or since. They invented Christianity with its built-in suicidal teachings to confuse, debilitate, and destroy their enemies. How effectively they did so, we shall soon see. During the early centuries, in the rise of the great Roman civilization, Rome fought and overcame its many surrounding enemies. As Rome expanded, one of the greatest threats and its most dangerous rival was Carthage, who had established a powerful empire on the southern shores of the Mediterranean, directly opposite from Rome. For 120 years, these two rival nations intermittently fought each other in three major wars in a life-and-death struggle. Finally, when Rome triumphed, they leveled Carthage to the ground, killed the men, and sold the women and children into slavery. Carthage was wiped from the face of the earth and was never again to rise as a threat to Rome. A few centuries later, in the year 70 A.D., the Jews of Judea rebelled against the Roman authorities. Emperor Vespasian sent General Titus to Jerusalem with a few legions. In a siege similar to Carthage, General Titus devastated the Jews, leveled Jerusalem to the ground, and either dispersed, killed, or sold the population into slavery. Now, we would think that in a fate similar to Carthage, the Jewish threat would have been liquidated forever and wiped from the face of the earth. But not so. On the contrary, history shows the Jews survived and the Romans as a race perished. The Romans declined rapidly after they embraced Christianity, while the imported slave populations multiplied rapidly and replaced the original Roman stock. By the year 476 A.D., the Roman Empire collapsed miserably, and the original Roman racial stock, for all practical purposes, can be considered extinct. The Jews had their revenge. They had destroyed miserably and completely the Roman race, the Roman Empire, and the great Roman civilization, for all of which they harbored an intense and pathological hatred. How did they accomplish this? They knew they could not overcome the Romans in open combat, in which the Romans excelled and the Jews in any case are physical cowards. Being a parasitical race and the supreme masters of deceit, they decided to employ their special weapon, namely mind subversion. They decided to destroy the Romans by deranging their brains, and they decided to employ religion as their most powerful weapon with which to warp and cripple the Roman mind. They decided to take full advantage of those two weaknesses to which the otherwise intelligent white man is so susceptible, namely gullibility and superstition. They invented and foisted on the Romans a new and suicidal religion, Christianity, a religion that has plagued and crippled the white man's thinking to this very day. Its founder supposedly was one Jesus Christ, who, according to Luke 2:21, was a circumcised Jew. What is it about Christianity that is so devastating and suicidal as to cause the breakdown of the great Roman civilization and plunge the white race into the dark ages of superstition and ignorance, poverty and misery, for the next 1,000 years? If we examine the New Testament, we don't have to go far from its original first few pages to find out. In the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6, 7, and 8, we find a mythological Christ dispensing the following suicidal advice. Sell all thou hast and give it to the poor. Love your enemies. Turn the other cheek. Resist not evil. Judge not. There is more real bad and suicidal advice that, if followed, must surely lead to self-destruction and extinction of those that take such idiotic advice seriously. Let us examine a little more closely just how crazy and how destructive the above five teachings really are. Let us examine the idea of sell all thou hast and give it to the poor. If everyone was a so-called good Christian and followed that advice from their early youth, there would be no one that would ever build a business, build a home, or build a family. As soon as they had earned 2 dimes to rub together, they would immediately transfer such to the freeloaders, parasites, and the niggers, who would be there waiting to relieve the working white Christian of his hard-earned savings. More likely still, the Jew who doesn't believe in such nonsense would beat the other parasites to the punch in relieving the foolish but gullible white man of his earnings and property. A fool and his money are soon parted. In any case, if we were all good Christian chumps, there would be no substantial citizenry left who could support the building of roads, harbors, airports, cities, homes, industry, factories, or anything else. We would, in fact, soon be reduced to a straggling horde of meandering bums, without money, without homes, without industry, without jobs, without food. Civilization would break down and be reduced to primitive barbarism. Or let's take the idea of loving your enemies. If you hadn't fallen for the first bad piece of advice of foolishly giving everything away to the freeloaders, but were gullible enough to succumb to the idea of loving your enemies, the end results would be the same, suicide and destruction of yourself. If, instead of giving it away, you did manage to accumulate a home and some property, you would, in short order, be beset with thieves, pirates, and robbers, who would quickly relieve you of your money, your home, and any other belongings. Why wouldn't they? You love them, and especially since such victims would also be imbued with the stupid Christian idea of turning the other cheek and not resisting evil, the robbers would have a field day, and you would be right back where you started, with nothing. You might as well have stuck with the first suicidal concept and given it all away in the first place. The end result would be the same. You end up with nothing. The Jews and the parasites end up with the hard-earned fruits of your labor. There is much more bad advice in the Sermon on the Mount. For a fuller examination, read chapter 13 of Nature's Eternal Religion, entitled The New Testament. Suffice it here to say that any reasonable and intelligent analysis of the bad, poisonous advice that is interlarded and interlaced throughout the New Testament always leads to the same inevitable results. The end result is self-destruction and suicide. We might well ask, why would anyone be stupid enough to want to buy such a load of garbage? It is incredible that anybody would, but we come back to those two mortal failings of the white man's mind, namely gullibility and superstition. and the treacherous, cunning Jew played on those weaknesses to the hilt. Strange and incredible as it may seem, the Jews were successful in peddling this suicidal new religion to the Romans and their rapidly mongrelized and deteriorating offspring of imported slaves. History tells us that the Romans bought this garbage of Christianity from the Jews. In fact, Emperor Constantine, himself a treacherous criminal who murdered his own wife and son, among many others, and who was later canonized as one of the saints of the Roman Catholic Church, in the year 313 AD decreed that Christianity was now the official religion of the Roman Empire, to the exclusion of all others. By the year 476 AD, the Roman Empire had collapsed completely. The superlative white Roman race, who produced the most splendid civilization in the golden age of classical history, and perhaps to this very day, was for all time wiped from the face of the earth. The Jews did it by feeding the Romans a suicidal new religion. The Romans bought the new poison, hook, line, and sinker, and the victims died from it. The Jews had their revenge. The collapse and destruction of the Roman Empire is undoubtedly the most colossal tragedy in the history of the white race. The original Romans exemplified much that is best in the white race. They were a brave and noble people. The Romans were creative builders and organizers. They were resolute and tenacious, strenuous and indefatigable. Daunted by no reverses or misfortune, they never admitted defeat, having a strong sense of discipline and duty. They were clear-headed, businesslike, and efficient. And finally, they were not a mere fighting race, but one gifted above all others with a genius for consolidating and organizing, and for the forming and administering of laws. Their civilization lasted for 1,000 years. It left the white race a proud legacy of laws, customs, art, sculpture, language, architecture, and government that persist to this very day. Our debt to the now extinct Romans is very great indeed. In contrast to the Romans, the Jews were the very opposite. They never built any civilization, created no art, architecture, sculpture, or anything else of value. Yet the Jews are the oldest surviving race in the world today, who have appeared and reappeared in the histories of all great white peoples, such as the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, etc., for the last 5,000 years. Their most predominant characteristic has been their cunning and deceit in boring into the vitals of other nations, sucking out their lifeblood and destroying them. They are doing just that to the productive white race today, here in America and in the rest of the world. Since the white race as a whole, but especially here in America, is the victim marked for mongrelization and destruction, it behooves us to seriously study our tormentor and find ways and means of warding off the suicidal path on which we, the white race, are now programmed. First of all, let us analyze why the Jews have survived for 5,000 years when more intelligent, more healthy, and powerful nations such as the Romans did not survive. Why did the Carthaginians disappear from the face of the earth when Jerusalem suffered a similar fate, but the inferior Jews survived to destroy the Romans? There are many reasons for this. But the overwhelming reason lies in the Mosaic religion of the Jews, which is tailor-made for this parasitic race. The Mosaic or Judaic religion has bound the Jewish race together in a fanatic loyalty that has not been matched by any other people. It has done more than that. It has given them a purpose and a program that they have pursued tenaciously for the last several thousand years. In essence, that program is to garner unto the Jews all the wealth and riches of the world and to subjugate all other people as slaves to do their bidding. A tall order, but they have been extremely successful and are nearing their ultimate goal. Their Mosaic religion has done more. It has given them a philosophy which has been the core around which they have rallied throughout their long and tumultuous history. stripped of all the window dressing, that creed essentially boils down to this. What is good for the Jews is the highest virtue. What is bad for the Jews is the ultimate sin. Nothing else matters. The survival and welfare of the Jewish race above everything else. The Romans, on the other hand, had no such religion. True, they had a confusing array of gods, Mars, Jupiter, Mercury, Venus, and a host of others, but they meant little to the unity or stability of the Roman race. They gave the Romans no particular creed, no goals, no program, no purpose. Their religion was nothing more than a superstitious indulgence in a world of fantasy. Above all, it did not promote racial loyalty, the one ingredient that must be the core of any creed for the survival of a race. Having no serious or worthwhile religion of their own, the Romans were highly vulnerable to the cunning of the treacherous Jews, who, as we have stated before, are history's masters of deceit and the most insidious and crafty mind manipulators the world has ever known. The Jews had one other advantage. Unlike Carthage, they were not concentrated in a Jerusalem or even in Judea. They were dispersed all over the Roman Empire, parasitically feeding especially on the trade routes and centers of commerce. They dominated the money market, the slave trade, and many other nerve centers of power. Above all, they stuck together like glue. Since the Romans had no good religion of their own and were therefore highly vulnerable, the Jews went about their destruction with a vengeance. They invented Christianity soon after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. They invented the horrible concept of hell, like the boogeyman we described earlier, to terrorize and panic their foolish victims into submission. With these formidable weapons, especially the fear of hellfire and torture, they wreaked havoc on the superstitious and the gullible. The victims swallowed the whole package, including the suicidal concepts of sell all thou hast, love your enemies, turn the other cheek, resist not evil, judge not, and a whole passel of other idiotic and suicidal advice. The befuddled Romans, who in their past history had been realistic, down-to-earth, taking good care of their affairs here on earth, the only place man has ever been known to live, now lost their sense of reality. Instead of pursuing their earthly duties, as Christians their minds now meandered in a fantasy world of spooks. Their empire, their civilization, and their race went down the drain, down the sinkhole of history, never to rise again, with the Jews in control of the wreckage. 1,500 years later, the Jews are still in control of the white race, even after having subjected us to 1,000 miserable years of the Dark Ages. We are still stuck with the same suicidal religion that warped the brains of the Romans and orbited their minds into the unreal world of spooks. In the meantime, the Jews have strongly consolidated their gains. Over the centuries, they have either strengthened or added to their arsenal of weapons with which to exploit and control their victims. Some of these tools, other than religion, are, first, money. The Jews control the gold, the finances, the banks, stock exchanges of the world. Second, propaganda. The Jews control the newspapers, wire services, television networks, movies, book printing and distribution, magazines, and every other meaningful facet of the news and influence-wielding media, both here in the United States and throughout the world. Third, education. How the Jews control and blanket our educational institutions is too broad a subject to cover here. Suffice it to say that they coerce our children by force of law to attend, then indoctrinate and pollute their impressionable young minds with destructive and depraved Jewish ideas, most of which will lead to race mixing and the racial poisoning of our future generations. Fourth, government. Having control of the nation's finances and news media, they control our government and are all over it like a swarm of locusts. This applies to all governments of the world. Their most usual trick is to have some white Gentile yokel, preferably Anglo-Saxon, as frontman, and have him surrounded by the real manipulators of power, all Jews. If we take a look at the bureaucrats in control in Washington as of the summer of 1975, we find Gerald Ford, a white Gentile, acting as the stooge and frontman. He is surrounded by Henry Kissinger, a Jew who is Secretary of State and also the Director of the National Security Council. In these two offices, the fate and security of the nation hangs in balance, yet it is in the hands of a Jewish communist traitor whose loyalty is to Israel, to communism, and to the Jewish worldwide network. But this is only the beginning. Head of the Defense Department is a Jew by the name of James Schlesinger. The head of the Treasury Department is a Jew by the name of John Simon. Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board is a German-born Jew by the name of Arthur Burns, alias Bernstein. Ford's financial advisor is a Jew by the name of Seidman. The federal insurance advisor is a Jew by the name of Bernstein. Press secretary to the president is a Jew by the name of Ron Nessen. Ford's chief speechwriter is a Jew by the name of Friedman. Head of the Economic Council is a Jew by the name of Alan Greenspan. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare is a Jew by the name of Caspar Weinberger. The Attorney General's office is in the hands of a Jew by the name of Levy. Even Betty Ford's secretary is a Jewess by the name of Mrs. Weidenfeld. They make sure they have all the bases covered and leave no nerve center of power occupied by one and not of their tribe. The cast of characters changes constantly and has changed by now, but it is always a Jewish cast. Now, so far, we have been analyzing the problem. But what is the solution to the disastrous and sinister calamity which the white race finds itself boxed into today? Are we doomed to mongrelization and extinction the Jews have scheduled for us like they did the Romans? Or is there any hope whatsoever that the white race will awaken, shake off its stupor, organize, and forcefully seize control of its own destiny? We of the Church of the Creator say that we can free ourselves from the sinister vice in which we are now locked, and that we can regain control of our own destiny. We must. It is a matter of life and death. That we are in a horrible dilemma, there is no doubt. In 1920, the white race of the world was outnumbered only 2-1 by the colored and mud races of the world. Today, it is outnumbered 12-1 and rapidly shrinking, while the mud races are exploding at an unprecedented rate, engulfing the white race even in their traditional homelands, such as America and England. The Jewish United Nations gleefully predicts that in another generation, the white race will be outnumbered 49-1. At the rate we are going, that will most surely happen, and by that time, it will be too late. Reduced to impotence, the white race will be massacred by the flood tide of mud races at a given signal from the Jews. For generations, the mud races have been goaded and incited to hate whitey all over the world and will be eager, ready, and willing to slaughter us as soon as they have the upper hand, and especially as the struggle for food becomes more critical. We of the Church of the Creator are convinced that we can stave off this horrible disaster, and we have the creed and the program to do it with. Had the Romans possessed it, the Jews would never have had a chance. Had the Romans had a racial religion like creativity instead of their meaningless gods and spooks, what a different world this would be today. Instead of a world rapidly degenerating into chaos, flooded by a starving mass of mud people who cannot cope, and a world exploited by the Jewish network, we would today have instead a beautiful world populated by a creative, productive, culture-loving white race. It would be a beautiful world minus niggers, Jews, or hordes of subhuman mud races. The genetic, cultural, and technological progress that would have evolved in the ensuing 1,500 years since the Romans perished would be a marvel to behold, something that can only tax our wildest imagination. Such a world as the Romans would have built had they marched forward with a strong racial religion is the goal of the Church of the Creator. It is not too late. What we need today is a completely new direction, a powerful new religion for the white race, a religion based on the superlative value of our race. In creativity, we have such a religion. The central core of our religion, creativity, is the survival, expansion, and advancement of the white race and the white race alone, to the exclusion of all others. We are taking the most salient page from the history of the Jews. The golden rule of the Church of the Creator reads, what is good for the white race is the highest virtue. What is bad for the white race is the ultimate sin. Period. Organized and united, the white race is 10 times more powerful than all the Jews, niggers, and mud races of the world combined. We of the Church of the Creator mean to organize that awesome potential of white power for the benefit of the white race. We mean to put every white man in the position where he will have to openly take a stand, either for the white race by word, deed, and action, or be exposed as a dastardly traitor to his race. There will be no Mr. In-Betweens. Whereas it is impossible to set forth our entire creed and program in this limited dissertation, we want to urge you to read and reread the Bible of our religion, Nature's Eternal Religion. It consists of 508 pages and 49 chapters. It is divided into two parts. The first half is entitled The Unavenged Outrage and sets forth the problem. The second half is entitled The Salvation and blueprints the solution to the problem. The whole book can be considered the creed and program of our religion, namely creativity. I have said that it is the core of our creed to advance the welfare of the white race, to expand it until we ultimately inhabit all the good land of this fertile planet, and above all, to keep our race pure, to advance it to ever finer genetic levels. In no way does this imply waging wars of extermination against the mud races, should this be your impression. Nor do we want to enslave any other race. We mean to pursue the same program of expanding the white race as the white race pursued in the winning of the West and the building of America. We mean to apply the American way to the winning of the world. The essential part of our program is racial loyalty, providing for the best interests of our own people, the white race. It is our unalterable position to stop subsidizing, feeding, aiding and abetting the scum and parasites of the world that are now devouring our productivity and consuming our largesse. Just as the inferior American Redskins were not able to compete with the white settlers, so the mud people of the world are not able to compete. It is only because of Jewish control and the perverted sense of confused loyalty that the white race is now shrinking its own, feeding and expanding the mud races to where the very survival of the white race is now in dire jeopardy. It is stupid, idiotic, and suicidal to shrink our own and expand our enemies. We of the Church of the Creator mean to reverse this process. We mean to practice white teamwork, racial loyalty, to expand the white race and to shrink the numbers of the mud races by letting them shift for themselves. We mean to expand our numbers and our territory in the same way that the white man did throughout the world during the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. The first phase of winning our fight for survival lies in bringing the white man's thinking back to sanity. The biggest obstacle we have to overcome is not the Jews, the niggers, and the other mud races, but first of all, straightening out the white man's confused thinking. In order to survive, the white race needs a new creed, a new philosophy, in short, a completely new religion. The white man's thinking must shake off the Jewish cancer that has beclouded his mind for the last 2,000 years and face reality. That is what the religion of creativity is all about. It is based on reality. It is not based on pie in the sky when you die, nor fry in the sky when you die. Nor is it based on a fantasy world of spooks in the sky to whom we might vainly implore, plead, and pray for our welfare. No, We are done with all that superstitious and primitive nonsense, and throw it all overboard. Our religion is based on reality, the laws of nature, which are eternal, which are real, which always have been the same and always will be. And one of the highest laws that nature has spelled out to us, as to every other creature, is the survival of our own kind. This law transcends all others. Had the Romans realized this, had they kept their race pure and pursued the survival, expansion, and advancement of their own race, this would be a far better and superior world today. There is much more to our program and creed. There are the 16 commandments of the Church of the Creator. There is the program spelled out in the chapter entitled The Road to Greatness. There is a picture of a bright new world of the future towards which we are striving. It is all contained in our Bible, Nature's Eternal Religion. I urge you not only to read it, but study it daily. There is much to be done if our great people are to survive. The first constructive thing you can do is to avail yourself of the book, read it, and then distribute it among your white racial comrades. The next thing you can do is to organize. Well, read the whole program in the White Man's Bible, Nature's Eternal Religion. Remember, to be skeptical and of an inquiring mind is no vice. To be gullible and superstitious is no virtue. And may today be the day when you take a stand for the white race, when you dedicate yourself and your future to the building of a whiter and brighter world of tomorrow. Thank you.
Well, that's it from the great Ben Klassen, who sacrificed and martyred himself to get the word across to people what they've got to do, how they've got to change their whole way of thinking. And you can't do it by right-wing conservatism with Christianity and all that stuff. It just don't work. Now, my differences with Ben were primarily I didn't believe in a church, calling it a church, and I didn't believe in an organization in the sense that big meetings, rallies, and so forth. I felt that time was over a long time ago. And we should operate as independent lone wolves all over the place, all over the country, all over the world. We can build on a local basis, operate individually, and if we decide to, we can strike fear into the hearts of the enemy, too, if we decide to. And that's up to each individual how they operate that. So anyhow, this Labor Day 2016, I hope you enjoyed our program, and I'll be back tomorrow. Ooh, we're going to have a substitute show tomorrow because I have to go into I have to go to the doctor again. Don't worry, I'm not dying. 14.5.